Are you willing to tell the select committee what you know about events leading up to, during,
I've been clear all along. I've got nothing to hide. I've been straightforward all along.
Oh, hello, Jim Jordan from October.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN. In Palinville, New York on WLPP, in Rochester, New York on WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950, KTNF, and yes, we stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and all of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling-ish edition of the Bradcast. Hello, Desi Doyen.
Hey, action-packed.
You did not think that 2021 was going to give up the ghost easily, did you?
I did not.
Well, as usual, some breaking news just before airtime today sort of throws everything off a little bit, but I will get to my guest today shortly, come hell and or high water, and I will ask her about some of this breaking accountability news, which has sort of been breaking all week, even as I have not been able to catch up with it. With Omicron and everything else going on at the same time. And in fact, it's kind of a big deal. On Monday, let's start there. The bipartisan U.S. House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, Donald Trump's last desperate attempt to steal the 2020 election by throwing his supporters at the U.S. Capitol, essentially, in hopes of obstructing the official joint session of Congress that was meeting to certify the Electoral College vote that day. That committee in the U.S. House has now turned its focus onto one of its own. At least as of Monday, it began. A sitting member of Congress, for the first time. On Monday, the January 6th committee asked Congressman Scott Perry, Republican of Pennsylvania, a member of the far-right Freedom Caucus from Pennsylvania, who has sort of flown under the radar. You're forgiven if you've not heard of him until now. Under the radar, despite being every bit as far-right as folks like Jim Jordan or Marjorie Taylor Greene and the rest, they asked Scott Perry for information about the attack on the Capitol. It was the first time that the committee has publicly turned in its probe toward a sitting member of Congress. The request, and it wasn't a subpoena, it was a request, said that the panel wanted to ask Perry about his text communications with former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, his alleged involvement in efforts to hijack the DOJ in advance of January 6th to keep Trump in office, and the congressman's involvement in conspiracy theories around Dominion voting machines. That request, in a very polite letter, came from the panel's chair, Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi. It was a letter, a request, not a subpoena. Perry, along with other far-right House Republicans like Congressman Jim Jordan and Mo Brooks and Paul Gosar and Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, they stoked rage at the evidence-free myth that the 2020 election was stolen. And they met with Donald Trump and his attorneys in an effort to contest the Electoral College certification on January 6th. There is a lot that they know. But the request to Perry notes that he played a specific role in the effort to manipulate the DOJ into helping to try to help keep Trump in power. Specifically, the letter from Chair Thompson said, quote, "We have received evidence from multiple witnesses that you had an important role in the efforts to install Jeffrey Clark as acting attorney general." Now, that was a scheme that only failed when the actual acting attorney general at the time, Jeffrey Rosen, and a bunch of other top DOJ officials indicated to Donald Trump that they would all resign en masse if the department was decapitated in order to put Jeffrey Clark in place to carry out a scheme to lie to swing state legislatures that the DOJ had found evidence of fraud in the 2020 election, and that those legislators should meet to choose electors for Trump, even though the voters did not vote for those electors. They voted for Joe Biden's electors. It was, to put it mildly, a very big deal, and it came extraordinarily close to having actually played out just before the January 6th joint session of Congress to certify the Electoral College vote. Now, Thompson's letter to Perry also noted his communications with the White House, including texts with Mark Meadows, which presumably the committee already has in its possession since Meadows turned over about 9,000 pages of documents before deciding that, oh, you know what, he didn't want to cooperate anymore with the committee. And he preferred instead, I guess, to be held in contempt of Congress and face potential jail time instead. That is what Mark Meadows is now looking down the barrel of for the moment. So that was Monday, this letter to Perry. By Tuesday, Congressman Perry made clear that he had no intention of voluntarily cooperating with the committee. He said on Twitter, quote, "I decline this entity's request." He called them an entity, claiming that, quote, "the radical left was desperate," quote, "desperately seeking distraction from their abject failures," and that the House committee was, quote, "illegitimate." Now, I'm not sure that committee vice chair Liz Cheney is a member of the radical left, but failing to describe the committee as a committee, calling them instead an entity, underscores his belief that the entire thing is somehow illegitimate. The committee,
his attempted claim that it's correct, illegitimate, even though it isn't.
Well, the committee responded within a few hours, noting that, quote, "multiple federal courts had rejected similar claims from former President Trump that it lacked a legitimate purpose," and said that the panel would consider seeking the information they needed from Perry, quote, "using other tools." Other tools, one would presume, would be a subpoena to a fellow sitting member of Congress to testify before a legitimate House committee. That subpoena has not yet come. It may be coming soon. But while Perry was the first sitting member of Congress to receive such a polite request from the committee, on Wednesday, there was another. Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio has now also been called in by the panel requesting an interview and information from him. And there's reason to believe he will, if we take him at his word, there's reason to believe Jim Jordan will be more than happy to come in and speak to the committee. In the letter to Jordan, Chairman Thompson said that they want the lawmaker to provide information surrounding his communications with then President Trump on January 6th and about Trump's efforts to challenge the results of the 2020 election. In other words, to steal the 2020 election, AP. The letter reads, "We understand that you had at least one and possibly multiple communications with President Trump on January 6th. We would like to discuss each such communication with you in detail." The panel is also seeking information regarding Jordan's meeting with Trump and members of his administration in November and December of 2020 and in early January of 2021, quote, about strategies for overturning the results of the 2020 election. The letter goes on to say that the committee is also interested in any discussions Jordan may have had during the time regarding the possibility of presidential pardons for people involved in any aspect of the Capitol attack or the planning for the two rallies that took place that day. Now, we already know that several of the planners of those rallies are already cooperating with the committee. And I suspect the committee already knows a whole lot about this. So they will know if Jordan lies to them, if, of course, he has the courage to show up. But why wouldn't he? Thompson writes that Jordan has already publicly signaled a willingness to cooperate with the panel's efforts, citing the lawmaker's quote from an October Rules Committee hearing when Jordan declared, "I've said all along I have nothing to hide."
I guess, are you willing to tell the Select Committee what you know about events leading up to, during?
I've been clear all along. I've got nothing to hide. I've been straightforward all along.
There you go. He's been straightforward all along. Nothing to hide. Now, we will see if that is true. Will he agree to talk to the committee, unlike Perry, if he's got nothing to hide? As the New York Times reported this week, the House committee now appears to have moved from plans to simply report on what actually happened on January 6th to making criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. Got anything to hide now, Jim Jordan? As the Times reports, as the House committee investigators sifted through troves of documents, metadata, interview transcripts, they began to focus on evidence of criminal conduct by President Donald J. Trump or others that they could send to the Justice Department. The question of criminality, the Times notes, goes far beyond contempt of Congress referrals that the House has already sent to the DOJ for folks like Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows for their refusal to cooperate with the probe, though those alone could end up, you know, giving those guys a couple of years in jail. Investigators for the committee are now looking into whether a range of crimes were committed, including whether Trump and his allies obstructed Congress by trying to stop the certification of electoral votes. That's something we already knew because Liz Cheney came out a couple of times and said it.
Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceeding to count electoral votes?
Well, if he did, that would be a crime. But they're also looking at whether there was wire fraud by Republicans who raised millions of dollars off assertions that the election was stolen despite knowing that the claims were not true, the Times reports. That is interesting. Wire fraud by Republicans who knew that the election fraud claims were not true, a claim that might be made by a committee with access to a whole lot of inside information, like email and text messages and testimony from hundreds of witnesses to date. In November, for example, the committee subpoenaed the chair of Trump's 2020 campaign, Bill Stepien. Along with that subpoena, the committee sent Stepien a letter saying, as manager for the 2020 reelection campaign, you oversaw all aspects of the campaign and supervised the conversion of the presidential campaign to an effort focused on Stop the Steal messaging and fundraising for that. That messaging included the promotion of certain false claims related to voting machines, despite an internal campaign memo in which campaign staff determined that such claims were false, according to the letter to Stepien at the time. Behind the scenes, the committee's day-to-day work is being carried out now by a team of 40 investigators and staff members, including former federal prosecutors. The panel reportedly has obtained more than 30,000 records and interviews with more than 300 witnesses, including about a dozen just last week, whom committee members say provided, quote, key testimony. I think it's fair to say that the committee knows a lot at this point, and anyone who tries to lie to them will be in trouble for exactly that, even if not more. Lying to Congress is a felony offense that a number of Trumpers, from his former 2016 campaign chair, Paul Manafort, to former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, to his buddy Roger Stone, they have all been convicted of doing exactly that, lying to federal officials, lying to investigators during Trump's own administration, before they were eventually pardoned by him. Although congressional investigators have no powers to actually charge a crime, their ability to subpoena documents and compel witnesses to testify allows them to reveal new details about events. And at times, that process leads to witnesses disclosing potential criminality about themselves or others. When that occurs, Congress can make a criminal referral to the Justice Department to increase pressure on the department to open investigations. So far, Attorney General Merrick Garland has avoided public statements about any of these issues and whether the DOJ is looking at them. So far, they have prosecuted about 700 people, but they were all folks that were, you know, on the grounds at the Capitol that day, breaking into it, breaching barricades, busting windows, beating up police. It remains unclear whether DOJ prosecutors are now trying to build cases against people further up the political hierarchy or connecting the attack to Trump himself and the aides and supporters who worked with him to overturn the results, something that is now directly in the bullseye of the U.S., the bipartisan U.S. House Select Committee. They are working toward forcing the hand of the DOJ, it seems, to do exactly that. Will it work? We'll see. But yes, I'll say it again. The walls are closing in on Donald Trump and friends. Let's see if our guest today agrees. Let's take a quick break here. We'll be joined to discuss that and much, much more in a bit of a year-end wrap-up of sorts as 2021, the best year since 2020, comes to a close. The great Heather Digby Parton of Salon and Hullabaloo joins us next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hey, this is Desi Doyen of the Green News Report and the broadcast. Did you know that you can help us stay completely independent over your public airwaves by signing up for a monthly subscription of any amount you like? Just go to bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yeah. Cannot say bye-bye to 2021 fast enough. And I'm sure 2022 will be, the year-end news with the rise of Omicron and the apparent fall of Joe Biden's Build Back Better agenda just before Christmas has not been good in too many respects. In too many others, however, it is not nearly as bad as I believe it's being portrayed by the corporate media, leading to an undeserved plummet in Joe Biden's approval ratings. It's kind of a vicious circle. The media highlight bad news and downplay or ignore the good. The public reacts negatively in opinion polls. The media reports on those opinion polls turning south. And in turn, the opinion polls fall farther, offering a rather skewed outlook on what's actually going on in the country that Republicans applaud, as it turns out to be a self-enforcing feedback loop against the Democrats. We've seen this pattern now again and again during Democratic presidencies in particular. In the meantime, while there is certainly much for non-Republicans to fret about at year's end, the news is not all that bad, even if many fewer Americans actually know about the good news, which corporate media simply does not focus on because, well, I guess if it bleeds, it leads. For example, as terrifying as the rise of Omicron is, on Thursday, the FDA authorized the first COVID-19 antiviral pill in the U.S. to protect against severe disease. The oral drug from Pfizer will be prescribed at first for use in adults and children age 12 and up with mild to moderate COVID who are at risk for severe disease or hospitalization, according to the FDA. The authorization marks, quote, a major step forward in the pandemic, according to the director of the agency's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research in a statement. This authorization provides a new tool to combat COVID-19 at a crucial time in the pandemic as new variants emerge and promises to make antiviral treatment more accessible to patients who are at high risk for progression to severe COVID-19, she said. While the pill from Pfizer is not a replacement for vaccinations, they add an easily administered treatment to help keep people at high risk of severe illness out of the hospital. Pfizer's CEO said in a statement Wednesday that the company is ready to begin delivery of the drug to the U.S., quote, immediately. This breakthrough therapy, which has been shown to significantly reduce hospitalizations and deaths and can be taken at home, will change the way we treat COVID-19, he said, and hopefully reduce some of the significant pressures facing our healthcare and hospital systems. Pfizer has said a final analysis of the clinical trials found its drug to be 89% effective at preventing high-risk people from being hospitalized or from dying from COVID. That, I think it's fair to say, is very good news, as it could become a game changer in this seemingly never-ending pandemic. The treatment, by the way, needs to be taken early to be effective, within 5 days of first symptoms, according to the FDA. Dr. David Boulware, an infectious disease physician at the University of Minnesota, said getting tested for COVID as soon as symptoms occur is very necessary in order to get this treatment. He said the Pfizer drug worked better than current monoclonal antibody treatments, some of which, it should be noted, are no longer effective against the Omicron variant. In other year-end encouraging news, the Biden administration, with the help of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, has quietly made progress on one major pillar of Biden's presidency, that is confirming judges. When it comes to getting lifetime federal judgeships through the Senate, Biden has surpassed what nearly all of his recent predecessors were able to accomplish in their first year, and the class of successful confirmations is easily the most diverse group of judges put on the federal bench by any past president. In 2021 alone, Biden has now gotten 40 federal judges confirmed to lifetime gigs. Just by way of comparison, in the same amount of time, Donald Trump got 18 federal judgeships through. Obama had 12. George W. Bush had 28. The most recent president to make similar progress in his first year was Ronald Reagan, who tied with Biden at 40. And then, of course, there's the economy, which I've been banging my head on this show over and over again in recent weeks, trying fruitlessly to counter the misleading media coverage about it, one of the key drivers of Biden's falling polling numbers. I've been banging my head to note that, never mind misleading inflationary numbers, the U.S. economy under Joe Biden has, in fact, been booming. Just today, I got a little bit of help in that argument from a place you might not suspect, Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal. Don't believe a progressive talk radio host? Well, maybe the Wall Street favorable paper owned by the guy who owns Fox News might help you pay attention to how the bulk of the corporate media have been wildly misreporting this story in recent weeks and months. Of course, to the frothing approval of Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump and their fellow Republicans. A booming U.S. economy is rippling around the world, leaving global supply chains struggling to keep up and pushing up prices. That is Wall Street Journal's lead today, a booming U.S. economy. They report the force of the American economic expansion is also inducing overseas companies to invest in the U.S., betting that the growth is still accelerating and will outpace other major economies. Wow, sounds terrible. We better impeach Joe Biden. U.S. economic output, they report, is set to expand by more than 7% annualized in the first 3 months of the year. That's up from about 2% in the previous quarter, according to early output estimates published by the Federal Reserve Bank. That compares with expected annualized growth of about 2% in the Eurozone and 4% in China for the fourth quarter versus 7% here in the U.S. Major U.S. ports are processing almost one-fifth more container volume this year than they did in 2019. Did you know that, or were you led to believe that a bottleneck at U.S. ports was a complete disaster and failure by the Biden administration? That, even as volumes at ports in major European ports are roughly flat or they lag behind 2019 levels, the busiest U.S. container ports are leaping ahead of their counterparts in Asia and Europe in global rankings as volumes surge, according to the Wall Street Journal. In Europe, durable goods consumption is showing nothing like the boom that is ongoing in the U.S., said a member of the European Central Bank's six-member executive board. Consumption of durable goods has surged about 45% above 2018 levels in the U.S. Meanwhile, in Europe, it's only up about 2%. The U.S. accounts for almost 9/10 of the roughly 22 percentage point surge in demand for durable goods among major advanced economies since the end of 2019, says the Bank of England. Very strong U.S. demand is certainly where global supply bottlenecks began, says the head of the container ship giant A.P. Moller-Maersk. The U.S. economy will likely grow by around 6%. In 2021 and 4% or more in 2022, the highest rates for decades, according to analysts. Strong U.S. growth momentum is expected to push the unemployment rate to the lowest level in almost seven decades by 2023, according to Deutsche Bank. Wow. No wonder the bulk of the media is reporting that the U.S. economy is a disaster. U.S. economic output is likely to surpass its pre-pandemic path early next year, while output in China and emerging markets will remain about 2% below that path over the next 2 years, according to J.P. Morgan Chase. And yes, U.S. wages are growing by about 4% a year. That is above the pre-crisis trend rate, compared with less than 1% growth in the Eurozone. So there is more from the Wall Street Journal, but you get the idea. Over at Daily Coast, Mark Sumner picks up on the journal's coverage today to note, rolling into the holiday season, America is enjoying record low levels of unemployment and levels of economic growth that exceed the wildest unfulfilled promises of Donald Trump. But at the same time, CNN reports that President Biden's approval levels for handling the economy are now at record lows. The best economy in 50 years enjoys a 44% approval rating. The front page of Wednesday's New York Times contains nothing about the record pace of the economy. It does contain dire warnings about supply chain issues affecting Christmas gifts and what seems to be an obligatory feature on the threat posed by inflation. CNN offers up the story about Biden's bad economic ratings, but nothing on the booming economy. The Washington Post is economy-free when it comes to their front page, finds Sumner, either on paper or on the internet. CNN and other outlets have certainly not been slackers on the economic doom front, he writes. Every penny increase in the price of gasoline became a screaming headline, and repeatedly outlets ran stories in which they quoted people making outrageous claims of 30% or 40% inflation without even bothering to correct those claims. There are no headlines to report, meanwhile, that gas prices are down. There are no headlines to report that America is enjoying the best economy in 50 years under Joe Biden, unless you go to the Wall Street Journal of all places. So what is going on here? Isn't the actual bad news bad enough? Thanks, Joe Manchin and Omicron, without turning the actual good news into bad news? Here to join us with perhaps a thought or two about that and for a bit of an end-of-year wrap-up on all of this and everything else grinding the year into dust at year's end is our longtime friend Heather Digby Parton, longtime blogger at her Hullabaloo blog, where she's known simply as Digby, regular contributor at Salon.com, and the winner of the Sydney Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Okay, Heather Digby Parton, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Thank you for being had. I want to get to the undeniably bad news regarding Joe Manchin and Biden's Build Back Better agenda and some of the Trump accountability news that we've been talking about in the last day or so. I see that Jim Jordan is now being called in to the U.S. House Select Committee. So I want to talk about that and everything else that's, you know, sort of closing out this year with no small amount of disappointment for progressives and Democrats. But hey, what's with the corporate media? Is it just that if it bleeds, it leads? Or is it, as Washington Post's Dana Milbank suggested recently, something else may be going on here? He reported on a study based on something like 13,000 stories over the past 2 years that found coverage of Joe Biden in his first year in office is actually more negative somehow than coverage of Donald Trump in his last and arguably worst year in office. You know, the year that he tried to steal a presidential election. Any thoughts on what the hell is going on here, Heather?
Well, I mean, I think it's what we've talked about for many years prior to Trump. You know, there's this impulse, compulsion, really, on the part of the mainstream media, to try and you know, make their coverage even between the two parties, as if that somehow is the only fair way to portray what's going on in our political life. And you know, they had been greeted with hostility by the right for many, many years prior to that. In fact, back in the 1970s was when they really came up with this idea of just relentlessly hammering the media as being a liberal media and being an arm of the Democratic Party. And they worked it. I mean, it was a tactic. They admitted it. This was not a real... They knew it wasn't true, but they recognized, the Republicans recognized, that this would be an excellent way to... You know, what we always called, I'm sure you use this phrase too, was working the refs, where you constantly criticize and carpet the media in the hopes that, you know, when it comes down to making a decision here and there about which way they're going to go in a story or how to do a headline, that they're going to, you know, they're going to kind of second guess themselves and perhaps, not completely tell the unvarnished truth and you know, kind of couch the way that they tell the story so that it's more favorable to the Republicans. And it worked really well. It was something that went on for decades. And
so are we doing the same thing here, Heather? I mean, you know,
no,
they complain about the media coverage. We complain about the media coverage. Is it just the media doing their job and being tough on everybody?
That's what they would say. They would say, oh, you know, it's like, you know, this side says it's too hot and this side says it's too cold, so it must be just right. You know, they have this idea but that is not how the world works. You know, there is such a thing as reality. There is such a thing as facts. There is such a thing as providing an objective, to the extent possible, view of what's going on in the world without resorting to this. It's a very kind of cheap and lazy tactic on the part of the press to think, oh, if I'm just as hard on these guys as I am on this guy, that somehow or another that makes it fair, and that means that we're being objective. That is not correct.
If I'm just as hard on the guy who tried to steal a presidential election as I am on the guy who replaced him by trying to do the right thing, then everything is it's all fair and balanced at that point.
Yeah, right. I'm doing my job then.
Yeah, and to me, it's like this false equivalence between, oh my goodness, Biden's dog bit a staffer, as if that's the same level of a problem as somebody like Trump inciting an insurrection to overthrow the government.
Exactly. They've been reaching, and they, you know, and I knew this was coming. I could, and I wrote about it even before the election in 2020. You know, I said, look, get ready. the press was very hard on Donald Trump. They really were, and surprisingly so, and satisfyingly so in many ways, because he was such an incredibly, you know, reckless, corrupt, and, you know, literally insane president.
Well, we should say correctly so. They were tough on him because he did stuff on which they should be tough.
They had to cover it, and it was so egregious that they really couldn't not do it, right? I mean, it was so outrageous that they were forced, I think, in many cases, to go ahead and do that. And, you know, and to their credit, they have said, been very clear, calling the insurrection and the post-election nonsense of Donald Trump the big lie. But I knew that the impulse was going to be there afterwards to somehow or another, you know, revert back to their previous equilibrium where they could say that. And so they were going to be very hard on Joe Biden and the Democrats for trying to fulfill their campaign promises. I mean, because what that was, what their campaign promises were going back to a normal politics during an era in which the press was unrelentingly hostile to the Democratic agenda. Deficits and, you know, people have got to take their medicine and the government can't afford it and blah, blah, blah. That went on for years and years and years as a way they put their thumb on the scale against the Democratic agenda. And I knew that this was going to come back, particularly with such an ambitious, you know, platform that the Democrats ran on in 2020. And that's exactly what they did. You know, I mean, and, you know, in fairness, Biden did get, you know, a halfway decent honeymoon, which is rare these days, but he did. As the vaccines were rolling out and there was kind of a sense of, you know, just relief. And more importantly, the Republicans were back on their heels, right? I mean, they were kind of, they had Trump running around, you know, talking about this allegedly the stolen election and perpetuating the big lie. The Republicans lost the Senate, which I don't think they thought they would, and that kind of set them back on their heels. But they regrouped. And they regrouped, and then the press regrouped, and the minute that, you know, this all started to fall apart with Afghanistan, and then subsequent to that, all the economic stuff that you've just mentioned.
Well, let me, you know, I want to get to Joe Manchin and what all of this does mean for Democrats, but just to stick here on the media for one more moment, you know, our friend Eric Bollert, progressive media analyst with Press Run, he argues today that the media are failing in once again, focusing on their old favorite Dems in disarray storyline, you know, with their struggles, of course, to pass the Build Back Better Act, while in the meantime, completely ignoring the reason that that Democrats need all 50 Democratic votes in the first place, including Joe Manchin, is because not one single Republican is willing to join the effort in any way, shape, or form. I mean, in one sense, you know, we sort of expect that now. We take that for granted these days that, you know, that if Democrats want to pass anything, they got to do it completely on their own. But that is a fairly recent phenomenon. Just as it's a fairly recent phenomenon that Republicans will filibuster every single bill that is put forward by a Democrat, even stuff that they might otherwise support. Am I being too much of a whiner by noting that the really huge disparity in the way the media cover the left versus the past they seem to get on the right for so much? I mean, remember, Democrats worked with Republicans last year and for years, really, on many of the accomplishments of Donald Trump, including dealing with the pandemic, et cetera. It seems like it's just taken for granted now that, nope, Republicans aren't going to vote for anything. How are Dems going to get anything passed?
Well, that's absolutely right. And you know, I mean, think about it. There's a perfect example of this dynamic. Last year, when they did the COVID relief bills, you know, they were bipartisan all the way. Both parties voted for them, you know, no problem. This year, it was a totally partisan vote on the COVID. And they had to go through reconciliation for the American Rescue Plan. Mm-hmm. Because the Republicans just totally dug in their heels. And, you know, look, we're talking about people like Mitt Romney here. You know, our hero of Utah, who's, you know, what stood up against Donald Trump, supposedly. Susan Collins, the most concerned senator in American history. You know, I mean, you've got this group that, you know, they sort of fashion themselves as, well, you know, we're a little above all this Republican partisanship. We don't hold with that stuff. You know, all the retiring senators. you know, like Rob Portman or Richard Burr, all these guys,
nope.
who they couldn't even bring themselves to vote for the American Rescue Plan, which was, in, you know, we were in the midst of you know, a global pandemic.
To get vaccines.
And the world was coming to an end.
To get vaccines, to get, you know, checks in people's pockets, to...
to save the economy.
Yeah.
Which basically is what happened. I mean,
right.
it was all that money that went flowing into the economy because of, well, I mean, earlier bills too, but this one was the one that kept us going through the year, that has, you know, has made all those statistics that you just reeled off.
And that was,
and
none of that was called out. None of
no.
that was called out. They
never
it was just
said a
expected.
Word about
that. It was just expected. Oh, well, what are Democrats going to do now by themselves
That's
for the
what,
next?
No. Yeah. And it's worse than that, Brad. There's a gleefulness about it. Let's see what they can do. You know, let's get them off their high horse here and,
right.
see whether or not they can, you know, they can actually get anything done. I mean, there's definitely that kind of an attitude that you see, particularly in certain corners of the D.C. press corps. I mean, I used to call them the cool kids, you know, the village.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it the Village 2.0. And believe me, you know, they are just as bad in a worse way, let's just put it that way, as their predecessors. This, you know, this group, the, you know, Punch Bowl and, you know, Politico,
yeah.
You know, yeah. whatever their morning thing is. And, they, you know, there's this idea that, you know, it's the, they used to call it gotcha journalism. And what they're doing is that they're creating this tremendous hurdle that Joe Biden has to jump over in order to even, you know, come out even
yeah.
in this whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, forget, you know, actually succeeding. I mean, I don't think they're even going to let him do that. They're saying that he's failing when he isn't.
I know, that's what's...
that's what drives me nuts. There was an article on CNN this week talking about how his approval ratings on the economy are worse than Jimmy Carter's, and going on and on, this big thing comparing the two.
Yep.
Well, I mean, never once in the article did they mention that the reality between those two economies is entirely different. Jimmy Carter really was in the midst of a hellish, you know, they called mm-hmm. it the misery index, remember? I mean,
yep.
it was inflation, high interest rates, high unemployment, it
yep.
was everything.
Yep.
It's the opposite of what's happening now. The Wall Street Journal called it a boom, as you just pointed out. So, you know, this is, if you don't tell these stories in context, you're basically sort of, you know, reaffirming the idea that, well, there must be something to it. Look at old Joe Biden. He's worse than Jimmy Carter,
yeah.
which, you know, is mean anyway. But, you know, just it's completely non-factual.
So let's talk about the last time we had you on, Heather. It was back in October, and I look back at our conversation, and I headlined it that day when I posted the story, "Are Manchin and Sinema Trying to Kill the Bill?" Talking about the Build Back Better agenda. Now, at the time, at least it sure seemed like it to me. So here's my question. How about now? Should we, no, it's a real question. Should we take Manchin at his word that he is a no on the Build Back Better agenda? Or is this just another Joe Manchin drama queen moment to get the attention and to get the leverage back onto whatever it is that Joe Manchin may want to do at any particular moment?
Well, I mean, I had been one up until this point who said, you know, let's just sit back and let this thing unfold. These mm-hmm. are difficult. You know, this is sausage making. It's never easy. Let's just see what happens. But I have to say that after this announcement that he made, you know, last weekend, that I'm pretty convinced that the bill as currently constructed is probably dead. I just cannot see how they can, you know, get back to where they were, which means, you know, there's going to be battles in the House, there's going to be battles in the Senate if they want to revive some parts of it, which from what I gather from, you know, reading around, you know, the news and the various analyses is a possibility that some of the elements of the bill are retrievable, and maybe Manchin will sign on, maybe Sinema will sign on, who knows, and then you got to worry about whether or not, you know, progressives want to sign mm-hmm. on, and God knows who else, but that the idea of this big reconciliation bill to do something, particularly on climate, which is so vital that it makes my head explode, the idea that they
yep.
would just let this go, that hopefully that there's going to be some movement to do that. And, you know, I don't know if you've talked to Dave Dayan recently. You know, he's the executive editor mm-hmm. of the American Prospect. He's, you know, a guy we mm-hmm. know personally.
Yep.
He wrote a big piece in the New York Times a couple of months ago, sort of actually, you know, promoting that idea of simplifying the bill into, you know, two or three big chunks that are fully funded for 10 years, including climate. And I think I can't remember specifically what was in the in his
Yeah,
proposal.
It was like child tax credits and climate and something expansion of health care of some sort. I can't remember what it was.
Something like that, yeah. And then Ron Wyden has come out with the same thing. So, I mean, these ideas are coming from credible people with you know, great progressive credentials that can come forward and say, hey, look, you know, let's just talk about this in a different way, and we'll have to go back to the drawing board and maybe put together a different sort of package. And Dan's argument was very smart, which was that he was just saying, look, you've got to, if you want to do this sort of thing, you can't, A, overpromise, which is perhaps a legit criticism. I won't make that judgment, but that's what he said. But, you know, it's also that you've got to actually deliver some things that are big and that are sustainable and that are, most importantly, understandable. And a lot of the programs that were in Build Back Better were very complicated, kind of bureaucratic, you know, messes, largely because of the having to try and accommodate people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to try and make it fit into whatever their, you know, their you know, requirements were.
Well, if so they have any, yeah, I mean, if they have any real
on
ones.
On a given day, yeah, on correct. A Thursday as compared to a Friday, but, you know, whatever. They were dancing as fast as they could, trying to accommodate these people, which is why it's so funny that poor Joe is out there whining now about how, oh, they were so mean to me, and, you know, I just couldn't take it anymore.
It's,
like, you know, give
it's
me
pathetic. Let me do this, Heather, because I will point folks towards your article on that, how Joe Biden lost Joe Manchin and how he can win him back, which also cites our friend David Dayan, that's over at Salon. I'll cite that when I post today's show. But let me do this because I'm running along. Let me take a quick break, come back, because I want to get into, we'll only have a few minutes to get into some accountability questions and to some year looking forward questions. Stand by, Heather Digby, Parton of Salon, and of course, Hullabaloo. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, speaking with Heather Digby Parton of salon.com. Heather, I've got just a very few minutes here because there, as usual, is so much news all at once. But according to a bit of a bombshell from the New York Times this week that sort of got buried in all of the justifiable concerns about Omicron before the holidays, the investigators for the House Select Committee probing the January 6 attack on the Capitol and Donald Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election, they're now looking into whether a range of crimes were committed, including two in particular, whether Trump and his allies obstructed Congress by trying to stop the certification of electoral votes, and whether there was wire fraud by Republicans who raised millions of dollars off assertions that the election was stolen despite knowing that the claims were not true. Now, presumably, the House committee has a lot of documents from insiders, you know, who may be talking amongst themselves, admitting that, you know, hey, we know this fraud thing, this election fraud thing is not true, but we can raise a lot of money off of it. That would be fraud. That would be a crime. At least that seems to be the case the House committee is making. Now, the Times notes that congressional committees themselves have only the power to make criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. They can't actually indict. It would then be up to the DOJ to take action or not. So, Heather, doesn't this underscore the question of where the hell is Merrick Garland and the DOJ on all of this already, that it takes a congressional committee to bring out these facts? And B, will criminal referrals from Congress, if they actually, you know, send them to the DOJ, will that actually kick the Garland and the DOJ into gear to actually do their own probe? that it seems like they should have been doing for the past year?
Well, I don't know about whether or not they're doing a probe, or if they're not, why they're not doing a probe. It seems to me obvious that that should be part of the whole insurrection thing. We know that they are doing a great many prosecutions, and the interesting thing about this is they're prosecuting the insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol, but they're using this same law. In fact, they've tried it out on a number of the insurrectionists, and so far it's held up in court. Mm-hmm. The law that I'm speaking of is this one that says obstructing Congress, mm-hmm. and stopping an official proceeding. And that is very interesting because it's never been used in this particular way before. It's never used by Congress, and there is some question as whether or not Congress and fits the definition of official meeting, the electoral count or whatever. But so far, the DOJ has been using that. And what we don't know yet is whether or not there is knowledge between the committee, mm-hmm. in the Congress and the DOJ about using that in both cases, right? Because the committee just recently, just a week before last, Liz Cheney came out and quoted the language of that
yeah.
law,
yeah.
and she applied it to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I know.
I think that is a very interesting thing, and it indicates to me that maybe they are, I shouldn't say they're working in tandem because they wouldn't do that, but there is a knowledge between the two of them, the DOJ and the Congressional Committee, mm-hmm. that they're not necessarily stepping on each other's toes. And as a result, one is sort of doing one thing and one is the other, with the knowledge that they're kind of gathering. Like the committee's coming from the top down, mm-hmm. and the DOJ is going from the bottom up, and they're using this same process to try to get to these prosecutions and kind of looking at maybe putting some of these people at the top. People like maybe Jim Jordan, which
yeah.
I think would be more beautiful than I could ever imagine in my life. So I'm not sure about the DOJ, but I'm thinking that maybe there's more to it than we can see. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but
that's
how it looks to me.
And I keep asking, folks from Free Speech for People who have called for the resignation of Merrick Garland because he's not holding Trump accountable. I keep asking, are you sure? Do you know? Because if they do the investigation properly, we really shouldn't know that they're investigating it. They seem pretty confident that they're not. I guess the question now is, will the House committee, if they actually send them referrals, criminal referrals, how that cannot sort of force their hand, I can't imagine. But Heather, two more quick points here as we're running out of time at the end of the year. I've argued that the walls are closing in on Trump, and I don't know if it's going to be the New York State or Manhattan DA's bank tax and insurance fraud and racketeering investigation that's going on, whether it's the Fulton County, Georgia DA's investigation into Trump's attempted election fraud conspiracy, or whatever comes out of the probe of January 6th. But one or all of those probes, I believe, are going to result in a criminal indictment for Donald Trump himself. That's my opinion. So my question, A, do you agree? And the bigger question, if that happens, does that make it less or more likely that he will, in fact, run for president in 2024?
I agree with you that it's definitely a possibility. There's an awful lot of irons in the fire all mm-hmm. over the place, mm-hmm. and it seems likely that something could come up. And B, I think it will make him more likely to run for president, and I think the Republicans will back him even more strongly.
More likely?
Yes.
Wow.
I think that this is, this feeds into their sense of grievance. They're looking, they're going after him. It's a witch mm-hmm. hunt. Here they go again, and they love that stuff,
Oh, wow. Yeah, they make a lot of money off of that, especially when they run it through their right-wing media echo chamber.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I've been dubious about the fact that he's going to run again in 2024 because I think he actually hated the job, even if he loved the power, and that he would be indicted by then. But I think it's quite possible. You might be right, Heather, that if he is indicted, that just gives him more reason to run so he can complain how, oh, they're out to get me, to keep me from, they're trying to stop you from having me as your president.
And you can't imprison, I guess, or put on trial a sitting president,
right,
according to the DOJ opinion that everybody disagrees with.
So the quicker he can get back in,
the safer he is.
There you go. Heather, there's also the good-ish news that I'm still sort of cautious about today, that Omicron, for reasons not yet understood, is burning itself out quite quickly in places like South Africa and elsewhere, almost as quickly as it exploded there in the first place, and now is exploding here. Obviously, Joe Manchin and the Biden agenda is a concern, as is, Manchin and Sinema's unwillingness so far to reform the filibuster, to reform voting rights and election law in order to save democracy itself. So with all of this set, as the year wraps up, where are you? Is this a temporary bunch of bumps in the road or does it doom Democrats and democracy itself in 2022 and beyond? Do you see any light in the year ahead?
I wish I knew. I mean, I would love to think that they're going to somehow eke out some voting rights legislation, but let's face it, that's not going to solve everything either. You know, I mean, that's at best a stopgap measure. Hopefully they do it, but I don't know. And honestly, I think the next year is going to be very, very tumultuous, and I think that we are in for more of this kind of churning. I think we may look back on 2021 as being at relatively calm by comparison.
Oh, man.
Hopefully
not,
on the Omicron front.
Not the answer I wanted to hear.
I'm sorry,
Heather.
But I mean, we're going into an election year with a bunch of, you know, freaks.
I don't know what to say.
And you know, and we're still in the midst of this pandemic, which hopefully, if nothing else, that will have. I heard Dr. Fauci say this week that, you know, he's going, saying, is it going to be this bad next winter? And he goes, no. He said, there's too much. The disease will be endemic by that point, and it will just be part of the fabric of our lives. So, I mean, that's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's better than what we have, right? So maybe that's the light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay, I'll take it. Thank you. Heather Digby Parton, of course, you know her as Digby over at her blog, digbysblog.net, otherwise known as Hullabaloo. You can also find her many times a week over at salon.com and on the Twitters at Digby56. Heather, thank you for everything over this past year. Thank you in advance for everything next year. I hope that you and yours have a safe and healthy holiday, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Thanks so much for having me. You guys have a great holiday.
Thank you.
You too.
Okay, we're going to get there, right? We're going to get to the end of the year and beyond it.
Yes, we will.
Somehow. We'll get there. All right.
Forward.
Thank you. Moving forward. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen,
yes,
our producer. Thanks to everyone for tuning in today. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. All of our shows going back years and years and years, all of that made possible only by listeners like you. If you stop by bradblog.com, you can download all of our shows, and you can also hit one of those donate buttons, or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves through the end of this year and maybe some of next. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the Facebooks and the Twitters, you'll find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Okay.